I'll have to speak like that. Can you? I mean, this sort of seems to work. Yes. Okay, but that doesn't work. Can you hear me like that? Good. Do you want to lower the light? Is it darker or is it okay? It's okay. All right. Otherwise, please shout. Okay, today's week 8. Not the 8th lecture, but week 8. A few bits of admin first before we start, as often. I'd like to remind you that next week we've got a guest lecture. A colleague of mine from Heidelberg is coming, and she's going to talk about aspects related to pragmatics. Okay. Some people are wondering whether this is a regular lecture. Well, yes, it is a guest lecture. At the same time, it is part of the course. Obviously, since I haven't heard the guest lecture myself, I cannot decide to what extent I'm going to integrate it into what you need to know for the exam. But in principle, it just belongs to the normal lecture course. And the same is the case for the lecture that we're going to have in the last week when Paul Rayson is joining us for a guest lecture from Lancaster. Okay. I'd like to remind you of the deadline for letting me know, as many people have already done, if you want to do option one in the assignment. I have a slight backlog of emails. I haven't responded to everyone who has written to me asking about whether their pairs or triplets or whatever are okay. I'm planning to do this latest tomorrow afternoon once all the other things are done. But you'll hear from me. If not, please just resend your mail. You don't need to comment on it. Just resend it if for some reason something doesn't work. I've had, again, a few mails, one or two that don't seem to have arrived. And I sent some mails that didn't arrive. So I'm not sure. Just if you don't hear from me, just resend it, please. I'll say something about the assignments and about the data that you can use, particularly about option one at the end of the lecture. So there were some questions, and I'll try to address those. Also, I have now uploaded the audio of the last lecture, but I'm having serious problems extracting the information from the video. My keynote just basically quits with a message. There isn't enough disk space. There is 700 gigabytes of disk space left, so it must be something different. I don't know. I keep trying, but the audio is there and the slides are there, so in the worst case, you have to click yourself. Okay, any other organizational questions? I'm going to hand round something that you will need later. Okay, you don't need to look at it yet. You can if you want, but it won't help. I've made 50 copies, that should be enough. I'll also upload it to StudIP for the people who want to, who are only listening to this and who are not here. Yes. Okay, shall we start with linguistics? Today's session is going to be a bit more theoretical. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at mechanisms of language change. I'm going to introduce you in particular to one way of explaining language change, namely by looking at grammaticalization theory. I'm going to show you a number of slides. Two or three I'm reusing from the introductory lecture, and I'm also reusing some slides that some of you, maybe one or two, may have seen in a 301 course that they attended, but there will be also plenty of other slides that you haven't seen. So, yes. Language change. We've looked at various types of language change. We've looked at pronunciation changes to some extent, or at least we've heard about them, we've noticed them. We looked last time at semantic change or at changes in the lexicon. I also mentioned towards the end of the last lecture that there are certain regularities in language in semantic change, and I'm going to come back to some of those in the course of today's lecture. Of course, there is also grammatical change or syntactic change, grammar encompassing both morphology and syntax. And that's the emphasis of today's lecture. There are other types of change, pragmatic change, etc., etc., but that's how far we got so far. Just to illustrate what I mean by this, I'm going to show you something which you've seen before, namely the going to construction, which is a new grammatical form. Well, not new in the sense of this century or last century, but which is something which was developed in the course of, well, quite a long time possibly, but in a previous stage of the history of English. I've also talked about the progressive, I think, when I gave you the example of the house was building, and I showed you that things have changed from was being built, from was building to was being built. At some stage, of course, was building was also a new construction, which was then basically changed towards what we know nowadays as the passive, was being built. Okay. Or something like this. This has to be the silliest thing he's ever said. Has to be, or has to. Has to is something that's known as a semi-modal. You could say this must be the silliest thing he's ever said. But in recent times, and now I actually mean quite recent, so last century, it has become possible for has to have this kind of epistemic modality meaning. Okay. This is not must or have to in the sense of deontic, you must do this modality, but it's epistemic modality which looks at something and sort of reads something into it. So he is driving a Rolls Royce, he must be rich. This has nothing to do with him having to be rich, but he seems to have a lot of money, and we can see this because he drives an expensive car. This has to be the silliest thing. I'm interpreting something. This is an epistemic modality use of the semi-auxiliary or semi-modal has to, which is something that's very new. Fairly new, at least very new when you look at the long history of English as a whole. Okay. So these are examples of things that changed, and what I'm going to look at today is some of the mechanisms that can be seen behind some of these changes, or changes of this type. Okay. So what we've done so far by just looking at what has changed, to look at what has changed, but the more important question is, why does it change? What are the mechanisms behind this? Before we answer these in a bit more detail, I'd like to sort of step back and actually ask the question, and we could actually discuss this, and it would take at least 10 minutes, I guess, so I'm not going to do that, it would take too much time, but I'd like to list some of the reasons commonly given for language change to happen. And somehow, while I was preparing this lecture, I had a feeling that I had given them to you already, but I couldn't find them on the slides. So if I'm saying something that you've seen before in this lecture, then just shout. Why do languages change? Well, different views are expressed. Particularly the generative grammarians believe that language acquisition is the main force behind language change. How does this work? We have an innate ability to speak, to create, you have an innate competence that we acquire during language acquisition, and which gives us the basis of creating grammatical, well-formed sentences once we have acquired this system. Okay. The point is also that once we've acquired it, it's fixed. That's what people believe who adhere to that kind of view of grammar. Which means that once you're an adult, then your grammar, not necessarily your vocabulary, but your grammar is fixed. If that's the case, the only way to change is basically for the next generation to receive input from the previous generation to try and make sense of what's going on here and create a new grammar that is slightly different. Okay? And if that happens over generations, and if it happens according to the same principles with many children, then we have language change. Okay? This is one view, or one reason, or one motivation. Of course, we've seen language contact as a major motivation or motor, or reason for language change. The Norman Conquest having had a massive influence on the language, both in terms of vocabulary, but also in terms of syntax, some people say. Less so, but certainly this is something that has changed the language. Yeah. Then there is contact within the communities, and we're really talking about aspects of social linguistics here. People speaking alike who live close to each other or who want to associate with certain types of, certain subgroups, certain subcultures, etc. And the kind of aspects like prestige and others, etc., will lead to language change slowly, but again, over several, possibly generations, we will have quite massive change there. Okay. In a way, both language contact and contact within communities are sort of, they're basically different facets of the same type of change, I think. Contact. Okay. And then we've got language use. And in fact, people who subscribe to the first view will probably mostly say that's not true. That's not how it works. So there is some disagreement among linguists whether that's actually the case. What I'm going to show you for the rest of the lecture is, a look at this particular view of language change or the motivations between this particular type of language change, namely language change as a result of language use. Language use in the sense of that a speaker produces language and the hearer will try to make sense of it and will need to negotiate in some way or other the meaning that, or will have to interpret the meaning that the speaker presumably wanted to create. Okay, and I'm phrasing this very carefully because maybe I want to say something and you actually hear something differently. And the point is, if that happens quite often, language change might occur. At least that's what the grammaticalization theorists assume. And that's what I'd like to look at in a bit more detail with you today. Let's look at grammaticalization theory and the definition that is usually given. There are a few different ones. I've chosen the one by Hopper and Traugott in their second edition of the textbook on grammaticalization theory. I'll upload the... I'm preparing a list of all the references for you at some stage. I'll upload the complete list of all the references that I made in the course. And I'll then... Well, I should have actually done it a couple of weeks ago already, but I'm working on it now, so it's coming. Right, definition of grammaticalization: the change whereby lexical items and constructions, so it's not necessarily just one word, but it might actually be a sequence of words, come in certain linguistic contexts to serve grammatical functions. And once grammaticalized, continue to develop new grammatical functions. In a way, become more grammatical. So grammaticalization is a process or a set of processes, or in any case a change, where we start from a lexical item, from a literal, from a word, so to speak, and or from a lexical item like a noun or an adjective or something like that, and eventually end up with a grammatical feature of the language. Now I already illustrated this to you in the introductory lecture a while ago on the basis of complex prepositions, and I used it there to make a different point. But I'd like to get back to those slides again in the context of grammaticalization theory. Okay. Last time, when I showed those slides, I made the point that for, in example one, the man claimed he spoke for a large group, is in the same syntactic slot or has the same function in the sentence and in fact would be interchangeable with on behalf of in the second sentence. A few months earlier, Lord Wheatley spoke on behalf of all the High Court judges. For all the High Court judges, or he claimed he spoke on behalf of a large group of serving and former policemen. So we have on the one hand a single word, a preposition, very clearly a preposition. And on the other hand, we have on behalf of, which consists of three orthographic elements, but the claim is that they are together just as much a preposition, a single preposition, with a grammatical function of a preposition as for. Okay. Of course, we can look at the words themselves and see, yeah, but there is behalf in there. And I can say things like on his behalf. So I can use the word behalf as a lexical item. Yeah. The claim is, this is how it all started, but it then eventually changed into something where on behalf of became a grammatical unit. Just to give another example, again with a complex preposition, here we haven't got the same meaning, here we've got the opposite meaning, against versus in favor of. Again, we have the same syntactic function. That's what I'm claiming for the time being. You have to believe me for the time being, but I'd like to substantiate this. As a single preposition taken up by three orthographic units. There are quite a few of those in the English language. Let's click here. In terms of, in front of, in relation to, and others. In fact, I'm going to say a bit more later on about the last one, namely in view of, but they're not extremely frequent, but they certainly exist as an element of grammar in the English language. Now, in the introductory lecture, I already asked the question to what extent we can actually claim that they are units, that they are, so to speak, retrieved from our memory as a single chunk. Okay. I think it's uncontroversial that words like against are not put together when we produce language by combining the sounds that make up against, but against is just one unit. Okay, we retrieve it as a lexical item. And the point I made in the lecture was that something like in terms of or in pursuit of is also retrieved as a single unit. And I showed you how we can use the analysis of filled pauses to substantiate that claim. I'm not going to show that to you today, but the point I made then is still the same, that data suggests that they are indeed units. Of course, there are counterexamples to this, or there are sentences that you can use as counterarguments. If you've got something like in hot pursuit of, then we have something that I would have claimed is a complex preposition, in pursuit of, where we have a pre-modifying element hot. Okay. The nominal element is pre-modified. The fact that it is pre-modified suggests that it's got an internal structure. Otherwise, he couldn't pre-modify it. If there is an internal structure, it isn't a single unit. Yeah? So if you look at examples like this and take a purely syntactic approach, then syntacticians who take that approach come to the conclusion that complex prepositions don't exist. Okay? For example, if you look at the Cambridge grammar, the big Cambridge grammar by Huddleston and Pullum, 2002, then they explicitly state, look at examples like this, we have pre-modification, it's not a unit, full stop. Okay. Now, I think they're wrong. I think that's not the whole picture. Okay. I'd like to claim that these animals, these features or whatever of language do exist as single units, and that they grammaticalize, that they change from a lexical or from a sequence of lexical units towards a grammatical unit. And there are a number of processes involved in this that you see not just with grammaticalization, not just with complex prepositions, but you see them with many other elements that change from lexical items to grammatical elements in the language. So, the claim is we start with three individual words and we end up with one unit. And the question is now, and I'd like to do this as a brief overview, which processes are typically involved while this happens? This doesn't yet answer the question why, but it's a beginning of trying to answer that. Well, it's the beginning of trying to answer that question. As I said, I'd like to do this with the example in view of. Okay? Which is not a very frequent complex preposition, but it's still fairly frequent. Okay? In view of, well, let's look at some examples. That basically is the link to the previous lecture. When we have elements that grammaticalize in the language, then we typically have a change in meaning that goes along with it. We have semantic change. And what typically happens is that, well, that typically, it's almost invariably, that it changes from a literal meaning to an abstract meaning. What do I mean by literal meaning? Well, here's an example from 1661, Robinson Crusoe. Okay. In this manner, we came in view of the entrance of a wood. I think you can see how this is literal. You can see, well, you can see that seeing is involved, right? In view of the entrance, there is ocular vision, there is direct vision between, well, the person who sees and whatever they see. Okay. They were yet barely in view of their mistress's house. Okay, same thing. Now have a look at this one here. In view of the large number of requests made, we are unable to advise you pre-departure if they cannot be met. Is there vision involved? Well, sort of. It's some kind of metaphorical vision, is it? Not. It's some kind of. It's not. It's clearly not vision in the literal sense. We could see. Well, we could imagine some kind of bulk of papers or a whole heap of papers full of requests and looking at them and then coming to a conclusion, sorry, we can't help you. Yeah? But what's much more likely is that it's some kind of more abstract sense of viewing, some sort of recognition that something is happening. Yeah? So, we no longer have a literal meaning, we have an abstract meaning. In view of your comments, I think we can safely tell the hotel what to do with their bed. Again, this is not looking at the comments, but this is interpreting the comments or interpreting the content of the comments. This is very different from in view of the gate. Okay. Or, third example, in view of the great speed of this. So, we could almost say that there is a causal relationship. Because it has such a great speed, it does this. So, clearly a more abstract meaning, I think. Everyone, I guess, can agree with that. So, that's one of the mechanisms, or that's one of the processes that typically goes hand in hand with grammaticalization. A semantic bleaching, a change from something literal towards something more abstract. Okay, the next two processes, or the next two aspects of grammaticalization that I would like to introduce are best shown with a little figure like this. This is a figure which shows data in a historical corpus which I compiled from the 1650s onwards and then compares it to British English as represented by the British National Corpus. This is not an ideal comparison because the combination of this data, of the historical one, is not, not the combination, the contents of the earlier data is not exactly the same as the British National Corpus, but the picture is so extreme that I think we can still make fairly draw reliable conclusions. What we see here is that we're looking at the different meanings of in view of, namely the literal one that I showed you in the first two examples, and then the red bar refers to the complex prepositional, the abstract meaning. And what we see is that in view of before 1800, before about 1800, is invariably literal. There was no way in the English language, at least not as represented by the corpora that I've used, that it wasn't available as a grammatical element for speakers before 1800. Okay. Then in 1800, we have both. In fact, in the data, it seems to happen quite quickly. We have both the literal and the abstract meaning. Yes?
Did it become abstract because something new emerged? Or did it
Well, let's go back to that once we've gone through the different mechanisms, because the question of why is actually quite interesting in this context. Clearly something is happening, but how it's happening I'd like to say in a few moments. Yeah? Okay. And then if you look at how frequent the abstract version is, then you can see that it is massively more frequent than the literal one. Does that make sense? Well, yes, because what's happened is a generalization. Mm-hmm. A generalization in terms of its use. What do I mean by generalization? Well, the construction, the abstract complex prepositional construction, can be used in more contexts. Well, yeah, that sort of makes sense. In view of, in a literal sense, you can only use in contexts where you can actually literally see something. But as soon as we move this into the more abstract domain of recognizing or recognition or interpreting or, in fact, even saying something like causality, then you can use this in many more contexts. Yeah? It generalizes to more contexts where the original meaning of literal viewing is not available or cannot be applied. As a result, it becomes more frequent. So grammaticalizing constructions generalize and therefore typically become much more frequent. We'll see other grammaticalizing constructions that have become very, very frequent in English in a minute. Now, that's generalization. The second point is layering. Layering basically describes the fact that old and new can coexist. It's not that the language suddenly decides, okay, from now on we're going to have only abstract meanings of in view of, the other one is no longer available. It may be the case that one at some stage dies out, and if you look at the number of literal in views of in the BNC, then you can see that it is, well, it's a very, very small proportion indeed. So it seems to be a case of, well, one taking over from the other at a fairly rapid speed, but the old one still exists. Okay. So we've had semantic bleaching, or from literal to abstract, we've had generalization, and we've had layering. The next one is a bit more difficult, typically, to understand or to apply. And in fact, the piece of paper that I've distributed at the beginning is an exercise that I would like you to do at least a little bit, not now, in a few minutes, to do that with you. Subjectification. Well, there's the word subject in there, the I, something that is subject, well, that is more subject, well, I can't say the word now. Why don't I just read the definition? Okay. Subjectification refers to the development of a grammatically identifiable expression of speaker belief or speaker attitude to what is said. This is fairly abstract. Let's look at the examples to make sure that everyone understands what's meant by this. If we go back to the literal meaning of in view of, does this in any way express speaker attitude? Well, from hence when we went still south about 7 miles, all in view of this river. We're just looking at this. This is a sort of description of, I don't know, topography or whatever. It's a fact. It doesn't say whether the speaker liked it or not. Yeah, it's a description of that. But have a look at this. It's hard to see what else they could have done in view of the Secretary of State's decision. Isn't that some kind of interpretation on the part of the speaker or the writer? Mm-hmm. It links elements in the sentence, of course, but it also expresses some kind of speaker attitude. Would it not be possible to make an earlier start in view of the great need for homes, etc.? It's fairly subtle, but again, it's something that is related to the attitude of the speaker towards what they say. It's no coincidence that 12 and 13 are not literal instances of in view of, but are again the grammaticalized abstract instances. Okay? And it has become more subjective, or people are more subjective in using this, or are more expressive of their subjective needs and feelings and attitudes. Okay. So We've seen something that gets lost, semantic meaning, but at the same time, something is added. So we have semantic content that's gone. It's no longer vision. It's something more abstract. Some people call that semantic attrition. Okay. But at the same time, something increases on the level of pragmatics. It's more expressive. It's more expressive of the internal processes that are going on inside the speaker. Now, in fact, loss is not the loss in terms of semantics is not the only loss that we have. We usually, or very often in grammaticalizing constructions, also have some kind of erosion process. Okay. It goes hand in hand with phonological attrition or erosion. I'm going to do this, I'm gonna do this, I'ma do this, well, I'ma do this, something like that. Okay. And I think I've mentioned this before, something that's very frequent gets eroded over time. Again, that's a process that's sort of a concomitant of grammaticalization. Right, the next one, if you can still handle a few more. Long word, decategorialization. Well, the word category is in there. What's a category? A category is something like, for example, a word class, okay, a noun or an adjective. And each category in the English language, or in any language, has certain features. Okay? A noun can be put into the plural. You usually can put a definite article in front of a noun. Okay? You cannot really say in the view of, well, at least not when it's the abstract. You can say in view of your comments, but I can't say in the view of your comments. You can't say in views of your comments. You can't say in apparent view of your comments. Well, you can say in full view of your comments, but then we've got literal viewing again. Well, no. Yes, in full view. You can't say in full view of your comments. No? You can say in full view of the gate. But in full view of the comments, that doesn't work. Right? Okay. Because in view of the comments is more abstract. Okay. So in other words, the nominal element, which originally was a full literal noun, is no longer a noun, is no longer noun-like, is no longer part of the category noun. It has become part of a longer construction, longer in terms of letters used to write it, or whatever you want to say. But in fact, it has sort of lost its status as a noun. It's decategorialized. Okay? I think at least one more I have. And that's a very important one. Reanalysis. Okay. Let's look at a very simple tree of this preposition phrase. In view of the mountains. In literal view of the mountains. Okay, or the mountain. We've got a noun phrase, and inside the noun phrase, we've got a preposition phrase which is lower down on the syntactic hierarchy. In view of the facts, well, I said it's only one word, so to speak, it's only one preposition, so the syntactic structure is different. It's simpler. It is no longer a nested hierarchy, but it's basically just one preposition phrase. It has been reanalyzed structurally. Okay. The typical example to give in this context, not in view of, is the going to future. Okay? And I think many of you will have seen this before. I've modified it slightly. I'm going to London to visit Bill. Okay? We have going to, okay? But the to visit Bill is not the same, or at least potentially, not the same as in I'm going to visit Bill. I'm gonna visit Bill. In fact, this is entirely clear when we're looking at this use here. I'm going to like Bill. Let's look at what's actually happened here. What's happening here? In the first one, we have a verb of motion, or a verb of locomotion, as some people say. Okay? So you are literally moving in a direction, and you're doing this for a purpose, namely to visit Bill. Okay. What's the second one like? Does it mean that you are literally moving? Well, possibly. That's why I put the to London in the brackets. I'm going now to visit Bill. I'm going, as you can see, I'm moving to visit Bill. But we're not sure. It's, I think, ambiguous. Perhaps the default interpretation today is that this is something that will happen in the future. But theoretically, it could, or a speaker who said, I am going to visit Bill, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, may have meant, I am on the move towards a location where Bill is. Yeah? Mm-hmm.
But so I'm going to London, it's not considered literal.
Though. Yes, it's a literal, it's a literal meaning of going. It's a direction, it's a locomotive verb. Yeah?
Okay,
it's,
but you could then again sub-classify the meaning.
Sorry?
The most literal would be, I'm going to drive to London, if in effect you're going to drive.
No. No, because I'm going to drive, then you have not a going that is literal in the sense of, but yeah, then, because then drive is the verb, yeah?
Of course, yeah?
Okay. So going is usually not used in the literal sense in the progressive nowadays, okay? But we can assume that a few hundred years ago that would have been the norm. In fact, it must have been the norm because the going to future didn't exist. Okay. So what's being reanalyzed here? We have a change in structure. If you look at the structure of the first sentence, then that's a complex sentence. We have, I am going, a full verb, to London, and then to visit Bill is a subordinate clause, and it's a subordinate, a to infinitive clause, which expresses the purpose of my going to London. In the third sentence, how many clauses do we have? Well, we really have only one verb, one full verb, like. Yeah? Going to has now become an auxiliary. It is no longer a literal full verb, but it is a grammatical marker of futurity. I haven't drawn the tree for this, but I'm sure you can sort of imagine what's happened. Maybe there is a tree in a minute. I can't remember now whether I added it. I wanted to draw a tree, but let's see whether I actually added it. Yeah. So what's being reanalyzed? The syntactic structure, in the same way as we changed in view plus preposition phrase of the mountain, towards in view of as a single word and the mountain, in the same way, it's not the same structure, but in the same way something gets reduced, something gets more simple, something gets reanalyzed as a grammatical element. Yeah? So that going to is no longer what it used to be, but is now basically one word. In fact, an auxiliary. Yeah? The point that I made before is that I'm going to visit Bill is ambiguous. We can't really tell. And that's because reanalysis is something that you don't really see. There are contexts, so-called bridging contexts, where both interpretations are possible. In the first one, it's clear what the meaning is. In the second one, it's ambiguous, but potentially for some hearers, and for many of you, it will have been the case, this is already the reanalyzed form, and it can mean, I'm going to do this in the future. You only can be sure that the reanalysis has taken place when the construction or when the new grammatical element is used with verbs that are incompatible with a literal going. I am going to like. Well, you can't really go somewhere in order to like. Well, it's very weird in any case. Yeah? So you can go somewhere to visit, literally, but you cannot go somewhere to like. If you have a sentence like, I'm going to like, reanalysis must have taken place. And in fact, the idea is that these new areas where going to can occur, again, well, this is a case of generalizations. We extend, or the language got, or the use where, or the areas where this new construction was possible to be used got extended, got generalized, and we can see this once it's used with new verbs. Okay. In fact, the new verbs will probably have been used by analogy. Okay. The new construction was available and then could be extended to new verbs. So, reanalysis is a covert process. You don't see it. It becomes apparent when the use of the new structure is extended by analogy to contexts which would be incompatible with the original structure. So, reanalysis happens on the syntagmatic axis. It happens on the sort of horizontal axis, in the sense of the relationship between words in the sentence to each other. And analogy happens on the paradigmatic axis. You exchange one word for the other, and when this becomes possible, then that shows that previously reanalysis has happened. Okay. Right, let's move on to the question of why this happens. In this context, I usually ask students to think about what since means. Okay. I've done quite a bit of writing since we last met. Okay. This, well, is one meaning of since. Since Susan left him, John has been very miserable. Okay. Since you're not coming with me, I will have to go alone. Since you are so angry, there is no point in talking to you. There are two different meanings of since here. The first one is temporal. There is no way to interpret this differently. The second one is ambiguous, in a way. It has been the case since she left him for the last 2 or 3 months or days or whatever. But of course, we see, or we can interpret, or we can read into this some kind of causal connection. If your girlfriend leaves you, then you feel miserable afterwards. Okay. So there's clearly a causal connection between the fact happening one after the other and the reason for this happening. So the temporal meaning of since was the first one, is the older one. But there will have been contexts where what was said to be happening in succession will have been interpreted by by the hearer to actually mean because. And if that happens again and again and again, then we come to a stage where since has conventionalized to such an extent that it means cause. Okay. That it can mean cause. Again, we've got layering. We have the literal, not the literal, we've got the temporal since still, well, in use today. But the more abstract, cause is more abstract than time. Yeah. It's abstract to think of this, but if you think about it, cause is more abstract than time. Is actually something that developed out of an interpretation by hearers what the speakers must have meant. Not just once, not just 10 times, but possibly hundreds or thousands of times, and therefore it conventionalized. And that's one of the explanations why something like that can happen. So, again, the last one is only causal, while this one is a potential bridging context. And what actually happens is that, given the right context, we reinterpret what's going on. And that's why this process or this mechanism is typically referred to as context-induced reinterpretation. So it's a pragmatic factor in language change or in syntactic change. We'll hear more about pragmatics next time, but not from this point of view. So ultimately, language in use and interpreting what's going on can lead towards a change in the syntax of a language. It doesn't necessarily have to go that way. Just to give you an example here, after we heard the lecture, we felt greatly inspired. Does after mean because? Well, clearly, you can draw the connection here. Yeah? After temporally, yes, and there was a connection, and you can see that after we heard the lecture can be interpreted as meaning because of the lecture. But in contrast to since, after isn't yet, perhaps, I don't know, at a stage where this is not just a conversational implicature. Let me give you this example. The minute John joined our team, things started to go wrong. Is this temporal or is this causal? Well, it's temporal, but it's also causal, but that's a conversational implicature. This is something that we read out of the juxtaposition of what's of the propositions. So this is pragmatics proper. This is speech act theory, etc., etc. But already Grice said, it may not be impossible for what starts life, so to speak, as a conversational implicature, to become conventionalized. And that's what seems to have happened with since. And that seems to be the main mechanism, or one of the main mechanisms behind many of the grammaticalizing developments in the history of English, that we have speaker negotiation and therefore ultimately language change, syntactic change. This relies on frequency and repetition. This relies on something happening often. So to sum up on the different mechanisms involved, or to add some general points to it, this seems to happen always in the same direction. We don't have grammaticalization, or we don't have the development of new grammatical forms by making something, well, by changing something from abstract to literal. Virtually never. Okay, there are some counterexamples, but let's not go into detail here. This seems to be, if you look at it from sort of from the outside, if you look at corpus data, it's a gradual process. These things can take centuries. Okay? I talked about the progressive, and I've said that the progressive has changed in over the last 1,000 years or so. Okay? It also means that there are no clear-cut boundaries. There are some elements which are sort of more grammar-like and others which are more lexical-like. Okay? And finally, it's clearly the result of language in use. Language use shapes grammar is one of those slogans. Okay. I'm almost finished before the mini-break. Let's quickly return to in view of now. And let's return to this criticism by Huddleston and Pullum that it doesn't make sense for them, well, for complex prepositions to exist because there is potential pre-modification. Okay. I think it makes sense to claim that these grammaticalized units can be retrieved from memory as a single chunk. Okay. They're available as the tools that we have to use, well, to make sentences. Now, the fact that you can do something like in hot pursuit of doesn't mean that this is not true. It just means that if we want to, they are available on the basis of the compositional rules of syntax. Mm-hmm. I have the word pursuit. This is in a way some kind of layering. I have the word pursued, and I can put the words together and pre-modify pursuit. But it still doesn't mean that, in general, I might not retrieve in pursuit of as a whole chunk. This makes sense from a cognitive point of view. It's easier to get one word out of your brain than to put three words together. Sort of makes sense, right? So grammaticalization theorists believe that both is possible, that we can, if needs be, put words together and create sort of the syntactic structures and hierarchies that syntacticians believe exist. But once grammaticalized, it may actually be a different thing. There are many other examples of grammaticalizing constructions. This is actually quite contentious, but I'm going to give you the simple view here. This is the change from a locative towards the progressive. On hunting at a location, okay, which eventually developed into is hunting. Bothers me and others too. Okay. The indefinite article developed out of a literal one. Okay. We had a word in Old English which meant to owe, and this has eventually become today's ought to. So we change from need towards the more abstract concept of obligation. We also have words like, well, not words, but morphemes like full. Presumably this started in the literal way. A basket full of eggs. Yeah. A cup full of water, where it's sort of already been fused, and hopeful. Okay. Or we have a literal Old English word meaning state and quality, which has developed into a suffix in present-day English, a derivational suffix, and others. Okay. The general picture is always the same. We start from a content item, we move towards a grammatical word. That grammatical word may become more grammatical, may become a clitic. Here's a definition of clitic if you forgot what it is or never knew it, and then become an inflectional affix, and eventually, occasionally, disappear. Okay. So it's some kind of cyclical thing happening in the development of syntax. Okay, it's time for a break, I think. This time I'd like to give you a little bit of a longer break. Okay, a few minutes. And I'd like you to, well, either get a breather, 5 minutes or so, or stay here and look at the handout that I've given you, which contains, again, something which I believe is a grammaticalizing element or structure, not dissimilar from complex prepositions. Size nouns and type nouns, depending on which page you look at. Okay. And this is an exercise which I used in a MA course recently. Okay. These are constructions like heaps of or bunch of. We can talk about a bunch of flowers, right? But we also can talk about a bunch of idiots. Mm? In fact, we can even talk about a bunch of idiots, where it's sort of almost phonologically reduced. So have a look for a few minutes at what you've got on your handout. Consider which ones are the older, the literal forms, and which ones are the more recent grammaticalized forms. Think about what changes syntactically, what reanalysis is taking place, and also whether you see anything related to subjectification. Do expressions become more indicative of speaker attitude or not? I'll give you 5 minutes to do this. You can also leave and come back in 5 minutes if you want. But I think that was quite a bit, so you need 5 minutes break, okay? Okay, that was 5 minutes. I'm going to upload sort of the solutions or some comments, etc., on StudIP. But the main point here is that, again, we've got a similar kind of reanalysis taking place where we have a bunch of flowers, where bunch can actually be interpreted as the head of a noun phrase, and a bunch of what. And then the of what is sort of lower down in the hierarchy syntactically, towards a bunch of idiots, where bunch of is no longer a literal bunch, but actually has taken on the function of a quantifier. Many, or a group of, or something like that. Okay. So it's no longer the literal meaning. It's got, well, it's got, it's decategorialized. Okay, bunch is no longer a noun. Okay. We also have semantic and phonological reduction. Semantic reduction because we don't have the meaning of bunch anymore in the sense of putting something together in a bunch like a bunch of flowers. We also, and that's not something that you see on the handout, we have phonological reduction. We had a whole bunch of people. So it's undergoing the same kind of mechanisms again as we've seen before today. Why it happens is a different question. We don't have any time to do this now. But I think you've also seen that with the grammaticalized quantifier meanings, they're clearly more subjective. Okay. A bunch of idiots says something about the attitude of the speaker. Mm-hmm. A bunch of flowers doesn't. So it's something that happens very regularly. Let's get back to your question about why this happens within view of. Okay. I'd like to extend what I've said a little bit for a few minutes and then move over to the assignment. If everything I've said so far about the development of grammaticalizing constructions were true and applied to in view of, we would have to see in the data, in corpus data, examples of in view of that allow both interpretations, some kind of bridging context between the literal and the abstract meaning, as we've seen it with going to, where at least, where it's possible to not be able to say, is it literal going or is it going as a marker of futurity? The problem is, I looked quite hard, this was from my PhD, I didn't find any good ones. Okay, I couldn't find any examples in the corpus data that I had, which was quite a few million words, that seemed to suggest that reinterpretation was possible. Mm-hmm. This is the best one that I could find. Now, the native speakers might have something to say about this, but then again, this is from 1710. You are not native speakers of 1710 English. Our conduct is in view of an all-seeing eye. Is this literal or is this possibly abstract? It's probably literal, I would say, right? But you could theoretically say our conduct is such because I am aware of the fact that there is an all-seeing eye, God. Okay? I think this is not a likely interpretation, but it's the best I found. Okay. Now, the interpretation, there are two possible interpretations. Well, my corpus data isn't good enough. Okay. Or possibly something else is going on. And I'm nowadays more inclined to think that perhaps something else is going on. Let's have a look at another complex preposition, in front of. This is a more frequent one. They were sitting in front of the house. Very typical complex preposition. It was absent not all that long ago. People couldn't say that they were sitting in front of a house. They would have said that they were sitting before a house. Okay? It simply didn't exist. Nowadays, it's one of the most frequent complex prepositions. But it dates back to only the 18th century. Now, if you look at corpus data and see what actually happened in terms of the development, we see something that is slightly reminiscent of the last figure that I showed you, in the sense that something becomes more frequent, makes sense, that's what seems to happen in the context of grammaticalization. But if you look at sort of the change from I didn't make myself clear. This is not literal versus abstract in front of, because in front of doesn't have an abstract meaning. Yeah? But we can compare this to in the front of. Yeah? If we've got in the front of, then it's clearly put together on the basis of syntactic rules. That's something that we find at the beginning, but then that option disappears. Nowadays, you can hardly say in the front of. Okay? But in front of develops out of nowhere and becomes fairly frequent. That is sort of odd. I would like to know why. Because it behaves like a complex preposition, but it doesn't undergo the kind of change that we've seen within view of. It doesn't change from abstract to from literal to abstract. Okay? So it has the formal features of a grammaticalizing element. It decategorializes, it becomes fixed, etc., etc. But it happens fairly quickly, as within view of, in fact, and it's semantically transparent. We have no bleaching. Okay? So it's not the result of context-induced reinterpretation. But it's a grammatical element. It's a preposition. We can use it just as we use before. Okay? I'm sitting before the fire. I'm sitting in front of the fire. So basically everything that I've said so far seems not to apply to a large extent to in front of. Hmm?
So is it maybe not the in front of or in the front of, but rather the before the change in parallel?
No, before is still available. In fact, you can still say that you said before the fire. It's a bit more old-fashioned and stilted, etc. But in front of is the more common option today. Okay. The prepositional before, in terms of spatial relationship, is actually still fairly frequent. I was surprised how frequent it is in present-day English. Okay. So it seems to be just that a new complex preposition was added without replacing before to some extent. In fact, there are quite a few prepositions like this. By reference to... Come on, I clicked. Where is it? Ah, there. Okay. By reference to, in accordance with, in addition... to, in charge of, etc. These are all elements like in view of, but they are transparent and they sort of happen to come into the language fairly quickly. How can we explain that? Well, one explanation could be that they're loan translations. We're going back to language contact as a reason. There is apparently in older stages of French a complex preposition en place de. I think nowadays you can't say this anymore. I'm not a good speaker of French. Yeah. So you could sort of say that in place of could be a loan translation from French. Well, the problem is not all of the ones that we have do have equivalent forms in French, and some of them develop independently from their French counterparts. So you can't actually say that they're all loan translations or calques. So something else seems to be going on. And the solution that some people have claimed in this context relates to, again, the process of analogy that I mentioned before. Remember, analogy was the use of a new construction in contexts where it wasn't possible before. Okay. The claim is that grammatical structures may be supported by the similarity, by the formal similarity, with previously grammaticalized items. We have in noun of, or preposition noun of, or preposition noun preposition, in our minds or in our competence as something which can be a preposition or become a preposition. Mm-hmm. So the claim would be that this construction exists in an abstract state, okay, and if the need arises, it can be filled with new lexical items. And this then happens quite quickly, and the construction doesn't undergo the usual changes that we would associate with grammaticalizing constructions. So analogy to existing structures may actually create or sort of pull in new structures that are similar, but different. Okay. One way to support this view is to look at something which is really a contradiction in terms, low-frequency complex prepositions. Why is it a contradiction in terms? Well, complex prepositions are units of grammar. If units of grammar are the result of frequent repetition, but they're low frequent, then something doesn't work. Yeah? On the assumption that they've never been frequent, and this is, for example, the case with by dint of, okay, the word dint hardly ever existed. It's some kind of dent, it's some kind of hole. Hardly ever existed or was very, very rarely used in the English language in all stages of its history. But still, by dint of is something that is, well, it's a complex preposition that is well entrenched, that people know, that people use. It's fairly infrequent, but it's there. How can it be there if it didn't grammaticalize by way of frequent repetition? It's highly fossilized, but it's not quite clear how it got there. It can't have grammaticalized. There are some combinations in the BNC which are even less frequent and which have the feel of a complex preposition. This is an intuitive statement. Okay? At sight of those black figures, something happened. Okay? It feels like a complex preposition. I have no claim, no proof that it is, but it's parallel. In acknowledgement of this, somebody did something. Now, if you look at grammaticalization by analogy, or if you look at analogy as a mechanism behind language change, then I think it makes sense to claim that these low-frequency complex prepositions are formed on the basis of an existing schema, preposition, noun, preposition. And that simply new lexical elements filled the abstract construction. Some people, I mean, there is a field in linguistics which is called construction grammar, where they talk about different levels of constructions, sort of micro-constructions, meso-constructions, macro-constructions, etc. This would be on the meso-constructional level, and we have several lexical items that can fill this construction and actually realize it on the lexical level. So, not all grammatical change is the result of direct result of grammaticalization processes. These grammaticalization processes, if they happen, with all the mechanisms that I've shown you, can actually take centuries to complete. But once this kind of mechanism has happened a couple of times, perhaps something more abstract can exist or can come about, which would then open up new members, or open up the way to new members being added simply on the basis of analogy. Abstract? Yeah, well. In sum, I've given you a variety of individual mechanisms that seem to be driving forces behind syntactic change. Semantic bleaching, analogy, decategorization, etc., etc. It's interesting to see that typically they don't seem to be independent from each other. They seem to work together, well, not actively work together, but basically occur together. And they do this to an extent that I think it makes sense to talk of grammaticalization as one whole phenomenon, which has several different sub-branches or sub-processes. They are clearly language internal in the sense that it is a development that's motivated not by language contact between different peoples, etc., or by language acquisition, but it's something that's the result of people speaking with each other and interpreting what's going on. Of course, it's only some part of language change. We have other ways of influence on the syntax of English, for example, by loan translations. There are loan translations from French, which were basically borrowed over into English after the Norman conquest, and presumably they are not the result of grammaticalization, but that's sort of language external influence. Right, that's as much as I wanted to say about syntactic change and mechanisms. I'd like to say a few things about the assignment and the data now. Okay. Now, some of you will still perhaps want to make up their mind about whether you want to take option one or option two. Option one, I said, really requires some corpus data, and many of you will not have worked with corpora. Okay. And I'd like to just give you two, three slides to show what this would entail. Okay. For present-day English, I recommended the use of the British National Corpus. Okay. You can make your own password there. Okay. Please use your email addresses, your TRIA email addresses, otherwise you don't get full access. You can't look at the larger context of query results. There are two features, apart from the basic display of query hits, that are relevant for this task, namely distribution and collocations. I'd like to show you a few slides, and let's just assume we're looking at begin versus commence, okay, which is a very typical one. Okay. I'm not sure whether anyone's suggested that. I don't think I've okayed it for anyone, because I think this has been done too often. Yeah. First of all, when you do this, you need to remember, of course, that verbs can have different word forms. So don't just enter the word begin. You need to look for the whole lemma, begin, beginning, begins, etc. There is a link on the main entrance page which gives you a bit of information about the syntax there. When you do this, you get to a concordance like this, where you can look at the different meanings. No, we can look at the different uses of begin, and you'll get thousands, 42,000 instances of begin. You don't want to look through all of them. So you just look at the first 100, the first 200, or something like that. Because the texts in the corpus are not randomly distributed, some texts that are similar will be bundled together. So you can't just look at the first 100, otherwise you get a skewed picture. So you need to select show in random order, which I've done here. So that's why it now says show in corpus order. Sorry, this is very small, but it'll be clear on the slides once I upload them. So it's displayed in random order. And then you can look at how begin is used, with what it co-occurs. And you will very easily, even in the first 10 examples, see begin to do this, begin to verb. Okay, seems to be frequent. Is that the case for commence? Commenced his duties, commenced my full rehabilitation, and the commenced, and something happened, okay, etc. So it seems to be different. Typically, commence plus PP, preposition phrase, or noun phrase, both as a complement and an adjunct. So it's used differently. This is something you can simply see from the output, and you can draw conclusions about whether they are synonyms or not, in the sense of, could they be interchanged? You can also look with a distribution feature. You just select distribution in the pop-up menu and say go. Then you can get something like this. You can see that in academic prose, commence is fairly frequent. In fact, it's even more frequent in unpublished written material. I don't know why. Okay. Would you expect the same kind of frequency distribution with begin? You would expect academic prose to be slightly lower, right? Because commence is more formal. That's the case, but not radically so. Yeah. But begin is most frequent in fiction and verse. This is the kind of thing you can really do with only a few clicks. In fact, I was a little bit surprised, so I thought I'll add a third one. This is the distribution for start. Start is more frequent in spoken conversation and least frequent in academic prose. You can see very easily that we have two synonyms, but that seem to be used, or three synonyms, that seem to be used in different text types. Okay. The other feature that is important in this context is the collocation feature. Again, you just select collocations, press go, and press OK again on the next screen where some options are offered. Just accept the defaults if you don't want to go into the nitty-gritty. And these are now, after some playing with the display, the verb collocates of begin. You can select a listing of all the strongly co-occurring verbs or frequently co-occurring verbs in the context of begin. Begin feel, begin wander, begin had, okay. Well, it's probably had begun, okay. So it works on both sides. Emerge, cry, move. This confirms the kind of begin to verb construction. Yeah? If you compare this to commence, trading, may, will, must, avoid it. Training, scheduled, be, let, shall. This is completely different. Yeah? So these are clear pointers towards the fact that although from the point of view of semantics, initially, begin and commence seem to be very similar, but quite clearly they use differently in the language. And you can describe this. So what about historical data then? We don't have a BNC for historical data. Well, we have something known as the Helsinki corpus, much smaller, and it ranges from Old English to Early Modern English. This is available on the web in a very, very similar interface. This is password protected, and you cannot make your own password. If you want access to this, write an email to me, suggest a username and a password. Don't give me your regular password for your mail. It's okay to just have the password Trier or the first name of your girlfriend or whatever. I don't care. Yeah. Just nothing secure. Okay. It's not the same. It's much smaller. It covers 1,000 years. Also, it hasn't got any part of speech annotation, so you can't say, give me all verb collocates. Yeah? So it involves more manual work. And, of course, you need to consider spelling variants on the historical data. Where do you get spelling variants from? Check in the OED. Okay. By the way, if I say OED, I mean the OED at www.oed.com. and not the shorter Oxford English Dictionary or any of the other Oxford dictionaries, which are good, but you really need to work with a full, however many volume set in order to get at the relevant information. This is also true for the second option, where you can actually online restrict searches to a particular time span. Well, what if that data isn't enough? What if 1.7 million from Old English to 7 million words from Old English to Early Modern English isn't enough? Well, then I need to do some work for you. If you let me know exactly what you want to search for, okay, which word forms, which spelling variants, etc., then I will search it in data that you have no access to. For example, a drama corpus, historical drama, which covers about sort of, well, late Middle English to about 1900, many million words, and I will send you a file with the output. Okay. And you will then have to work on this manually. Yeah. So this is a bit more work. You won't get a nice collocation analysis, but you can still see how words co-occur with each other and what constructions are used with which verbs or which nouns or whatever. Yeah. The whole idea is of this assignment is not that you produce a 20-page Hausarbeit, okay, just to get this straight, please don't, yeah, because I will then have to look at it very quickly. Yeah. After the, 12th of July or something like that, I need to look at this very quickly in order to be able to tell you, yes, you can do the exam. Okay. So don't write masses of words, please. Okay. Write more mass or long Hausarbeiten. You also don't even need to put all of this in a fully coherent prose text. I'm quite happy with with bullet lists, etc. Not exclusively, but don't think of this as a proper Hausarbeit with an introduction and with all of those kind of things. Yeah. The idea is that you work with some historical data, that you test some of the mechanisms that we've seen in the case of the assignment. This has got to do with semantics and also with word formation. Not syntax, that's more difficult. Okay. And that you then submit it and that you do some work on that. I'm supposed to ask you to do some work, so that's what I could come up with. Any questions about this? Mm-hmm. Are you allowed to write? Well, it does say on the assignment there is a word limit, if I remember correctly, something like 1,000 words for this or 1,500. Check again. I don't know offhand now. Please make sure that you're not going overboard. Yeah. Okay. All right. Then remember next week. Guest lecture, Beatrix Busse on pragmatics and the history of English. See you then.